Senator Dick Durbin asked President Obama this week to give us an update on the 10,000 Syrian refugees the United States is supposed to be resettling. Today on the 21st, we speak with the senator and look into how others in Illinois are working to help these refugees.
They've suffered many years of displacement. They've suffered a lot of trauma. They've fled violence. They've fled war. And they're looking for stability and to be able to have the kinds of opportunities that places in the United States offer them.
Also, new overtime rules announced by the Labor Department this week. Today, we speak with one of the state's largest employers, the University of Illinois, about how managers are planning to deal with these significant changes. And finally,
a third of our clubhouse is from Latin America, and the pride that those guys took in the generations that came before them is evident. They don't just play for the White Sox, they play for a flag as well.
We speak to the producer and subject of a new documentary about Latinos in baseball. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. It's Friday. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's been plenty of action this week by lawmakers in Springfield, although nothing on the budget. The Senate did pass a bill already approved by the House to fund tuition grants for low-income students, what's commonly called MAP grant funding. We should point out, state Senate Republicans have said that Illinois doesn't have the money without a budget. That bill is now going to Governor Rauner. The Senate also passed a bill to regulate fantasy sports gambling, but that bill was put on hold after one supporter, Democrat Antonio Munoz of Chicago, filed a motion to reconsider, which prevents the bill from moving on to the House. And the state Senate voted to pass a bill that would make it easier for Illinois residents to register to vote. It's called the Automatic Voter Registration Bill, and it would make it such that wherever an eligible resident receives services at a designated agency, they would automatically be registered to vote in their local jurisdiction unless they choose to opt out, say like at the DMV. Joining us on the line to talk about this is Cook County Clerk David Orr. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. How are you doing?
Good, good. Now, it's pretty clear how this bill would make it easier for people to register to vote, but many supporters of this bill say it's about a bigger issue, voter access. How do you think this bill would improve voter access across the state?
Well, so many ways, Nyla. This really is a step forward. First of all, consider a couple quick key factors. A great number of Illinoisans move all the time. These are people that still want to vote, and often they don't realize that their registration didn't move with them. So we have great mobility. Second, we have technology abilities now, okay, that we can share data. So just give me one example of why this automatic voter registration is so important. People still can opt out, okay, but there's 700,000 people right now in the state of Illinois, okay, who are not registered properly because they've never changed their driver's license. Okay, you know, people often change it, but they don't always do it. So those people have a driver's license at one address and a registration at the old address. Now, that is wrong, and that's what we want to change. Okay, there, also related to this AVR, automatic voter registration, is a move that Illinois joined ERIC before. ERIC is a data sharing process with other states. Okay, all of this is going to make things more efficient, save money, and make our list cleaner. Okay, this is why any Republican not supporting this, I don't know what they could be thinking.
Well, what they've said, and I've heard from particularly from Secretary of State, not necessarily Republican, Secretary of State Jesse White, saying that this may make it difficult for the DMV to automate other things and slow down that process. What's your response to that?
No, I don't think so. We've been dealing with this for quite a while. Now, there's a lot of challenge that the Secretary of State's office has, but see, this will make it better in terms of cleaning up the list. Now, sure, there's challenges for every office, the State Board of Elections, other offices, including the Secretary of State's office. But I was about to say, for example, when you know that there's 60,000 people, okay, that are no longer Illinois residents that live in other states, and just with a stroke of the computer, we can have that cleaned up. When you know that there's 34,000 people that died outside of Illinois that are registered to vote in Illinois, and with a stroke of a computer, you can eliminate those things. And I also mentioned the 700,000 before that. What that does is, even though there's a little upfront work, okay, there's always upfront work when you're putting something in, but in the long run, and even the relatively short run, it saves so much. Your lists are cleaner. You're not mailing to people. Okay, those 700,000 people, Okay.
So you think that's actually going to maybe save the state some money, you're saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, just think of those 700,000 people that are registered to vote at the old address, okay? Clerks all throughout the state are mailing them things. Even the Secretary of State's office is mailing them things. And now, electronically, all we have to do is match that, and we wouldn't have this problem.
Where does Illinois stand in terms of comparison to other states with automatic voter registration? Are we ahead? Are we behind?
Well, no. Well, first of all, automatic voter registration, what we're talking about now, is only a few states have adopted it. Okay, but Illinois, in many other ways, is moving ahead by joining ERIC, that I mentioned earlier, the status sharing process, and because Illinois did these good things on motor voter and early voting and same-day registration, Illinois is seen as a state that is clearly moving toward expansive opportunities for people to both register and vote. There's automatic voter registration, which, by the way, remember, had Republican votes. That's important that people understand that. There was five senators, the Republican Party, that voted for it because they emphasized how this could both fight fraud and help keep the list cleaner. So I want to keep that point in people's minds, because why should we have 700,000 people register to vote in Illinois from the wrong address?
What's next for this legislation?
Well, next, of course, the House. In other words, it passed the Senate, like I say, with a bipartisan vote. And I think the measure will be the same, and that is, obviously a lot of Democrats support it. Can we get a number of Republicans, because a lot of Republican clerks, county clerks, support this because of the efficiencies? And then even the governor's comments were, at least I think, relatively positive, neutral, saying we need to find ways to do things more efficiently. So the battleground next will be in the House, hopefully to get some Republican votes, just like we did in the Senate. Because a lot of times there's political differences, but that's why I want to emphasize, by having an automatic registration, you're cleaning your lists.
That's Cook County Clerk. Thank you so much. That's Cook County Clerk David Orr on this automatic voter registration bill passing the Senate, as you heard him say, now headed to the House. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. Bye-bye.
On Wednesday, Senator Dick Durbin led a group of 28 other senators asking President Obama to fulfill the administration's pledge they made last fall to resettle at least 10,000 Syrian refugees this fiscal year. So far, less than 1,300 have been admitted, about 20% of those here in Illinois. Yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Senator Durbin by phone from Washington about why he asked, why he sent that letter to the president.
Well, we asked the administration to give us a report. The president had talked about at least 10,000 Syrian refugees in this fiscal year. There's just a few months left. So far, only 1,700 or so have gone through the process. It is a lengthy, elaborate, and should be very involved process. A lot of questions need to be asked. But if 10,000 is our goal, and it's a very modest goal, we wanted a report from them on the progress they're making and whether they can hit that number.
Senator, what do you want people in Illinois to know about this situation? We've seen so far a few hundred churches and nonprofit groups throughout Illinois who are working to resettle refugees here.
I made a point of meeting with the church groups and meeting with these refugee families. And I'll tell you, it really destroys many of the myths that are out there about who these people are. In 9 times out of 10, these are families who have been through the most devastating tragedies in their lives. They are trying to escape terrorism. They want to come to this country just for the peace, security, and opportunity. They're poor. Many of them bring children. And they go through an elaborate background check before we let them come into our country. This is something we've been doing in America for more than half a century. We are a caring and compassionate people. Of course, we're going to be safe and be careful, but we want to make sure we have a welcoming hand when it comes to people who are really suffering around the world.
Last fall, I know Governor Rauner said he wanted to halt the flow of Syrian refugees into Illinois. That was back after the Paris attacks. I think there were about him and 20 other governors who said that they did not want to allow Syrian refugees into the country or into their states. I know there's questions about the legality of that, but have you had any conversations with Governor Rauner since the fall about those statements?
I'm afraid our governor's reaction and the reaction of many other governors was really based on a misunderstanding of the refugee process, which can take up to 2 years before a person is cleared. I at one point just invited the governor very quietly to come meet with these families and listen to their stories before he reacts that way. He didn't do it that I know of. I hope that he'll reconsider.
Have you personally spoken with him about this situation?
No, I haven't spoken to him directly.
Do you feel like that's had any impact on the agencies working to bring people in?
Well, I can tell you that many of these agencies are sponsored by the federal government, and they're doing amazing work helping these families get their lives together. I've been with them in several different settings around the state, and if many of the critics of this refugee resettlement could meet these families, hear what they've been through, and understand that they're running away from terrorism, not trying to bring terrorism to the world, I think they'd have a different view of the refugee settlement situation.
Thanks, Senator Durbin.
Thank you.
As the senator mentioned, there are agencies working all over to resettle these refugees. There are 262 Syrian refugees who have been resettled in Illinois so far. We're tweeting at a map, if you follow the 21st, where many of those refugees are being resettled, not just in Illinois, but across the country. What is it like for these families once they get here? We just had a tweet from Hema Kumar. When you have it always, stability can feel really underrated. It's not. Thanks for that comment, Hema. For everyone else, you can always tweet your questions or comments for what we're talking about. 221st Show. You can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. Joining us now to talk about this is Lena Sergi Attar. She's co-founder and CEO of Karim Foundation, which works with refugees around the world. Lena joins us on the line from Lake Forest. Lena, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Can you describe the journey for us? What does a refugee family go through before they arrive in the U.S.?
A Syrian refugee family has gone through many layers of displacement, of moving from place to place inside Syria, finally going to a host country outside Syria, which is typically Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, staying for a very long time to be able to even start the refugee process through UNHCR. And as Senator Durbin just said, it's a very lengthy vetting process to get into the U.S., which usually takes about 18 to 24 months. So by the time a Syrian refugee family actually arrives to the United States, they have suffered through 2 to 3 to 4 years of displacement, of leaving their homes, losing everything that they have, and many layers of trauma as well.
And when they arrive, Lena, I wonder how often, as you said, probably these are people who've been displaced multiple times. I'm not sure how much they're arriving with. And I wonder how they begin the process to establish themselves and their families here. What do you all do to help them with that?
So when they arrive with very little. You can imagine a family coming with just a few suitcases of whatever they've had left that they're able to carry with them. The basic necessities, and sometimes not even that, and very little money because they've depleted their savings through this displacement and through this fleeing of violence that they've had to endure leaving their homeland. The refugee resettlement agencies and the different organizations that are helping Syrian refugee families resettle in the U.S. have to really start from scratch, from being able to help them find places to live in, furnishings, clothing, and as well as just the basic necessities of your everyday life here. How do you register your children in schools? How do you apply to get your medical health care get it all settled and get it running, getting a driver's license? It's an alien place for them to come into, and so they need all the support that they can get to help ease that process.
I know that some families are united with family members that are already in the States, and others, as you said, come and they're entirely on their own. Can you tell us about a family that your organization, Karim Foundation, has reached out to and helped?
We've reached out to several families in Illinois and across the country, and one particular family that we know, because most of our work specifically is helping Syrian refugees in southern Turkey, especially in the fields of innovative education and helping Syrian youth rebuild their lives. But in this process of working very hard with these families, we had one family that we do a program for called Support a Syrian Refugee Family, and that is in order to get children out of child labor in Turkey and send them back to school. And one of these families that we sponsor, the father was paralyzed, because of injuries inside Syria, and the three children who are 8 and 10, and they have a toddler, don't go to school because they have to take care of their father because their mother has to go out every day and find work to do to support the family. So this is a family we supported last year. We give them monthly support, and their children went to school, and they excelled at school this year. And we just found out last month that they have been resettled to Portland, Oregon, and we helped them as well get settled there and connect with people and local organizations. And we're really thrilled that this family that has suffered so much now is going to be able to have a second chance and be able to build a better future for themselves and the father to get better medical care. And hopefully they will be able to turn the page on what they've experienced and have a positive future.
Lena, was that family, that father, was he wounded as a result of an ISIS attack?
No, it was not an ISIS attack. It was just the result of being a civilian caught in the crossfire of the war. He was injured very early on in around, I think, 2011.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Lena Sergi Attar. She's the co-founder and CEO of the Karim Foundation, based in Lake Forest, working with refugees worldwide. And as she said, Lena, when you come back, I'm hoping you can follow up with us and explain with families like this what kind of support they get from the U.S. government. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a few minutes. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can tweet them to The 21st Show. That's 21ST Show on Twitter. I see some of those questions. We'll get to them after the break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Syrian refugees. How many have been resettled so far in Illinois? That's 2 days after Senator Dick Durbin asked President Obama for an update from the administration on the pledge to bring 10,000 Syrian refugees into the country so far this year. So far, less than 1,300 have been admitted. As we said, about 20% of those here in Illinois. My guest is Lena Sergi Attar. She's the co-founder and CEO of the Karim Foundation, based in Lake Forest, working with Syrian refugees worldwide. And Lena, just before the break, you were sharing the story of one family, the father who was paralyzed and the mother who was the children who were not going to school because they were staying home to take care of the father while the mother went off to work. And I think people listening might wonder, what help is the U.S. government giving families, especially if they're arrived and they need, as this in the case of this gentleman, they need some pretty serious medical help.
The refugees that arrive and that are resettled, they do get support for a few months in terms of their help with finding a place to stay. And this is all through the larger refugee resettlement agencies that are in place to take care of refugees that arrive to the United States. And they get help with their rent. They get help with getting settled in, getting the kids into school, getting people into the medical system. But that aid ends pretty quickly after a few months, where the refugees are kind of left on their own and need to be able to figure things out. And that's where the local organizations and local communities can play a big part in bridging the gap between the government aid and families being able to really stand on their own two feet.
Lena, we tried, our producers tried to find a family to come on the 21st and talk about what their life was like, particularly a family in Illinois. And I know that many of these families are not necessarily eager to talk with the media. And I wanted to ask you, why is that?
So it's for different reasons. Some refugees have arrived here, and they still have family in Syria. They're very worried about their family's security, extended family, friends, and how they will be viewed if they go on the media and speak about their experiences. It's a very scary thing to be from Syria and be able to speak your mind about what has happened and what you've experienced. So many choose to be quiet and not have that kind of media exposure in order of because of fear for their families. And then you have other families that really have just gone through so much and would like their privacy, don't like to repeat the stories of trauma that they've lived through, witnessing violence, experiencing loss, and then they just are shying away from that kind of attention. They come here and they really are looking to build their lives.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, I wonder then if groups like yours or other agencies are also able to offer psychological or emotional support for refugees when they're also here?
Absolutely. The Syrian Community Network, which is the local organization here in Chicago that has taken it upon itself to take care of the Syrian refugees who have been resettled into the Chicagoland area, they do have a lot of support, psychosocial support, and therapists on their board that help them take care of the families' psychological needs. Some of them, they need to be referred out to more stronger care, and some of them just really need somebody to continue to come and visit them and talk to them, especially the kids and the mothers, and offer that kind of emotional support, being able to tell your story in a safe place, and being able to just let go of all of that trauma and the experiences and be able to move forward.
Lena, President Obama's goal of bringing 10,000 Syrian refugees in by the end of this fiscal year, do you think that's enough?
Absolutely not. I hope that we're able to get to that point because, as Senator Durbin just said, we are far behind in the scheduling and the vetting process is extremely long, longer than any other vetting process for other refugees from anywhere around the world. If we want to reach that goal of 10,000 refugees, we have a lot to do between now and the end of the year. But even with 10,000 Syrian refugees, we're looking at 10,000 out of over 5 million Syrian refugees who had to flee the country and now are scattered across the globe. The United States is really not taking its fair share of the burden of this humanitarian crisis. And I feel that we need to really examine our American ideals and values in thinking about Syrian refugees. A lot of times Syrian refugees are unfairly compared with terrorism, extremism, ISIS, and this is the Syrian refugees are actually fleeing this exact same terror that Americans and all of us rightfully fear. They are not the source of this terror. They're not the source of this extremism. They're going through a thorough vetting process, and we really need to be able to step up and help more families continue to find safe haven in the United States, as this is the foundation of who we are as a country. And we also need to be able to stand up and try to pressure the international community to end the violence in Syria, end the war in Syria, so refugees can ultimately get their goal, which is to return home.
I know Canada has a program where if five or more people want to, they can join together to support a refugee family. Do you think the U.S. should do something like that?
Absolutely. Private sponsorship used to be a very successful program. It was stopped in the United States years ago. And I think in this case of the crisis of this scale, I think it would be very wise to reopen the idea of having private sponsorships for Syrian refugees and refugees in general, because as the government is putting a lot of constraints on the numbers which we can accept into the country, we found as an organization an outpouring of compassion by American citizens who really would love to open their homes, open their lives to bring in a refugee family and help them start their new future and pay for all of that. But it's just not allowed in the United States, and I think that would be a very good alternative to have.
Lena, much of the work your organization, the Karim Foundation, does is in Turkey on the southern Syria border. I know you're catching a flight to Turkey later today. What are you going to be doing?
So this trip is not going to the border. We're just going to Istanbul, where the UN is hosting its first World Humanitarian Summit. And this has been called by Ban Ki-moon to address the massive scale of this crisis, the global crisis of refugees and the humanitarian crisis that is, that Syrians are facing and other people are facing across the globe, because the solutions that we have to these kinds of crises have failed in scope and in scale and in imagination. They're very outdated. We're working on a lot of principles that were set in place by the UN after World War II, and none of this has prepared us to deal with a crisis of this scale. So a lot of large international NGOs, agencies, governments, smaller organizations, and local communities are all coming together in Istanbul this weekend and next week to convene and see if we can come to an agreement on basic humanitarian principles that everybody must follow, as well as having local and smaller NGOs meet with the larger agencies to see how each can benefit each other in helping people in need.
And agencies such as yours, the CARM Foundation, based in Lake Forest. Thanks to Lena Sergi Attar, co-founder and CEO of the CARM Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
$47,500. That's roughly the salary threshold for overtime pay announced by the Labor Department this week. It's about double the current level.
Our whole mission here is about strengthening and growing the middle class. And in order to do that, you need to make sure that middle class jobs pay a middle class wage.
That was Labor Secretary Tom Perez on NPR. The rule will make millions more workers across the country eligible for overtime. Now it's up to employers to figure out how to comply by December 1st. One of the state's largest employers is the University of Illinois and its three main campuses. Jamie Painter is Assistant Vice President for Human Resources for the entire U of I system, and she joins us now in studio. Welcome to the 21st, Jamie.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. What are you telling managers right now on the three campuses that you're responsible for?
Right now, we are working on our implementation plans. About a year ago, when the Department of Labor proposed changes to the rules, we developed a university-wide committee to look at the impact to our University of Illinois employees who may fall under the threshold for the new salary amount. And so we had representatives from our campus human resources offices, our grants and contracts area, our payroll and benefits, legal counsel, university accounting services, to look at the impact to our employees to determine how we were going to implement. So right now, we are working on communication plans. The Department of Labor just passed the rule changes on Wednesday. So we are now analyzing the reports to look at which of our employees across all of our campuses and our satellite offices in the hospital are now under that new $47,476 threshold to determine who will be impacted by this.
So if you're under that threshold, then theoretically you're eligible now for overtime in a way that you might not have been before. I know there's a couple exemptions.
Right now, until December 1st, when the implementation is the effective date, right now the amount is $455 a week, or that equates to $23,660 per year. So any employee who's not making that salary or who does not pass the duties test, because there's two tests to be exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act provisions, right now, correct, they are eligible for overtime unless they fall under other certain exemptions.
So I know there's lots of exemptions when
yes.
you're thinking about these rules, but maybe you can explain what the duties test is so people can understand at least what that is.
Sure. The duties test looks at the actual primary duties of the position. The most commonly known exemptions under the duties test are our executive, administrative, and professional categories. So those categories look at the primary duties. Is the individual using independent judgment and discretion? Is their primary role the management of other staff? So those are the kinds of things under the duties test that it's looking for.
Right, to figure out whether or not they're eligible for overtime. I feel like this is probably a little bit of a logistical nightmare for a large employer. And I wonder for you all, if you feel like what the university, the state university system, do you think that the issues the state university system is facing is generally the same for companies across Illinois right now, trying to get ready for this rule in December?
Yes, it is impacting all public and private sector employers across the United States. The Department of Labor is estimating it does impact over 4 million employees who currently are exempt under the current exemption criteria, who will now be non-exempt and now eligible for overtime. So it is impacting everyone across the United States.
And so what it sounds like the university is doing is a really comprehensive look at employees, see who qualifies, see who doesn't. What other things do you think employers have to do to change or update to be in compliance by December?
Well, you have to look at your payroll and reporting systems. If an employee is changed from an exempt status to non-exempt, then they will be required to report the hours that they work each day. Whereas right now, if you're exempt, you don't have to actually report each day the number of hours you're working because you're not eligible for overtime pay. So it doesn't matter if you work 40 hours a week or 60 hours a week, you're going to be paid the same salary. So you have to look at your time reporting systems, your payroll keeping systems, as well as your policies to make sure they're in compliance with the new regulations, and look at in your hiring employment practices when you're hiring individuals, making sure that you're classifying them appropriately based on their salary.
Have you all gotten a lot of calls to University HR this week from people asking, hey, am I going to get paid more in December?
We have. Our campus human resources offices will be implementing them on the respective campuses. So our university-wide committee is going to be developing and looking at our policies that we need to change, any of our HR systems, timekeeping as well. And then our respective campus HR offices will be implementing that in their campuses. So they'll be getting those calls from those departments and employees. We're trying to be very proactive in communicating as quickly as we can now that the final rules have been adopted. But we want to make sure that we specifically talk to those individuals who will be impacted. And we have to look at not only the salary test, but also the other exemptions. Because our faculty, teachers, they are exempted from the salary threshold. So the change to that does not impact them at all. Also, doctors, lawyers are in professions that are also exempted and don't fall under that salary threshold test. So we're making sure that we're being very specific and looking at each individual employee and their job duties as well.
I think people are wondering about the budget, and they're wondering, is this pretty much guaranteed then it's going to cost universities more in employee pay? And I imagine, like the university system, other employers, are they having to think about adding more payroll and labor costs to their budgets?
It can, because obviously we'll have a larger number of employees who are now eligible for overtime pay who were not before. And a lot of these employees historically may have been working over 40 hours in a week, given the nature of their job duties. So if they continue to work at that capacity, then we would certainly be required under the law to pay them at an overtime rate. So it could impact our budget and our payroll expenses.
And I think then people maybe think about the state budget issues. Do you expect that the university then may need to cut positions or reduce hours to make up for the increase in overtime?
We aren't at a point yet where we can make that determination. We don't know also the overtime hours for these individuals, how much they work, because they're not required to report that right now because they don't get paid overtime. So we don't have an exact number of how many hours these individuals who will now fall into this category of non-exempt are actually working to know how many hours they may be now eligible for overtime pay. So we're not at the point yet to be able to estimate that budget impact.
I know that many business groups criticize this rule because it doesn't take into account regional differences in pay and cost of living. There's just that salary threshold. And when we're thinking about Illinois and having campuses in very different parts of the state, whether that's Chicago, Urbana-Champaign, or Springfield, is that a concern for the U of I system?
It is. Obviously, we have different salary structures. We have a civil service classification system as well, and salary ranges for those classifications do vary based on the campus, primarily, again, because of the region and the different cost of living in Chicago versus Springfield versus Urbana-Champaign. So, yes, it can vary. It is a concern, and we try to be as consistent as we can to not cause any pay inequity. But you have to look at the region that you're in as well, and it's not always going to be the same salary range in Urbana-Champaign as it might be in Chicago.
Lots of work you guys are going to be doing between now and December, I imagine, to
yes.
get everything up to speed.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for taking some time to join us. Jamie Painter is an Assistant Vice President for Human Resources with University of Illinois Human Relations. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Coming up on the 21st, it's Friday, we're going to be talking baseball a little. There's a new documentary that's premiering on the Big Ten Network tomorrow night called Playing America's Game. Its main subject is Illinois historian Adrian Burgos Jr. He's going to be joining us in studio along with the producer of that documentary. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
It is a beautiful day for baseball as fans pack into U.S. Cellular Field in Chicago. This is where University of Illinois History and Latino Studies professor Adrian Burgos Jr. does his research. His life's work examines the complex history of America's pastime.
For many Latinos, baseball is about family. It's not just that guys are out there playing a game and we're attending as fans, but there's a history as to how all of us got to that moment.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st, and that was a scene from Playing America's Game. It's a documentary about Latinos and baseball. Its main subject is Illinois historian Adrian Burgos Jr. The documentary premieres after the Illinois-Michigan baseball game on the Big Ten Network tomorrow night. It's based in part on a book by the same name by Burgos. The documentary is produced by the Big Ten Network and the University of Illinois through the Office of Public Affairs. In studio with me now, one of the producers on the documentary, Caitlin Southworth, and Adrian. Welcome back. Welcome back to the welcome back to the 21st, Adrian. And Caitlin, thanks for being here, too.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be on.
Adrian, that's your voice at the top, saying that baseball is about family. And I wonder if I can ask you what first drew you to baseball.
Yeah, part of it was, and I'll give you a little scene. It's from my youth, and it's about going to a softball game after Sunday morning services and seeing the passion that my uncles, my relatives, my grandmother. This is in New York.
Okay.
And, you know, the passion that they shared for the game. And I'm like, wow, these people just earlier this morning were in church and they're, you know, worshiping and all that. And now they're playing baseball just as fervently.
Caitlin, you have family ties to baseball, too. What was it like for you to produce this documentary?
It really was like a love letter to baseball. I come from a very strong background in baseball. My mother is a Cubs fan, and so am I. My father is a Cardinals fan, and my brother is a White Sox fan. So it was there was some heads butting during the summer months when baseball was going on heavily. So it was a real joy to finally do a baseball story.
What was behind the Big Ten Network and the University of Illinois wanting to do this, to help tell this story?
To us, it was a really universal story. We love telling stories about strength and determination, and we wanted to show these baseball players not by their stats, but by the human being that they are. So we wanted to show the joy and the love of Latinos and really wanted to show that to people that might not see that on an everyday basis.
Yeah, and as we're thinking about that, Adrian, there's a line in the film, I think it's in your book also, that you say, studying Latinos in baseball allows you to understand migration, labor, and popular culture. And do you think that we don't tend to think of athletes who immigrate? We don't necessarily think of them as immigrants. We just think of them as athletes.
Yeah, and really what's powerful about it is, particularly with the Latino story, is that many of these men are coming as youth, as teenagers, and they're experiencing adapting to a whole new society. What's not different is baseball. Like, baseball is the common link. It's what brought them here. It's what gives them kind of a mooring in U.S. society. But, you know, with Sammy Sosa, when he first arrived, he was 16 years old. He was a teenager. He would have been the age of a high schooler here. And then even with Jose Abreu, he's coming as an adult, but he's coming into a new society, learning and adapting to a new language and cultural practices. And that is the story of immigration. And when I share this with my students, like, just understand that when they leave the ballpark, they go to a home. They have families. They go grocery shopping. They lived lives that we do. And so we need to understand how is that experience very similar to what we ourselves or what other immigrants do. They get compensated much better, but they still deal with a lot of the same issues.
All of them necessarily get compensated a lot better. I want to talk about, because there's a great part in the documentary that was the most interesting part to me, about all the 16 and 17-year-old immigrants who were playing in sort of in the farm leagues, I guess you would say. But before we get to that, I wanted to just ask you about the history of how Latinos were first recruited, where they were recruited into baseball, because, again, I think a lot of people don't realize the long history of Latin Americans playing baseball here and there.
Yes, and baseball arrived to Cuba in the 1860s. It arrived at the same time it was getting its footing in California. And Cubans began to play in U.S. college level, then professionally in the 1870s. And so the presence of Latinos goes back over 140 years. And then in the 20th century part of the story, what was really fascinating is that the story of Latinos shows how the color line was working. And in this instance, you had lighter-skinned Cubans, many of them well off, who were allowed to play in organized baseball. But the overwhelming majority of Cuban players and other Latino players were darker skinned, they were Afro-Latinos, and they played in the Negro Leagues. And there's also the case of a few that moved between the Negro Leagues and the Major Leagues because people didn't quite know what to do with Latinos. Where are they in this color schema of America? And that, too, would also affect how they thought about themselves.
This is called Playing America's Game. You have a book by the same name, and a lot of this film is based on that. Caitlin, was it hard to translate that into film and also condense it down into this version that's on air?
It wasn't difficult. It was just we have a half-hour show. There's 150 years of history that we have to cram into that. So we really took pieces of Adrian's message that he's been educating people on and sort of broke it down to the early stages of baseball, what they're facing in the major leagues today, the prejudice, some of the you know, feedback from that, and how they're dealing with fame and starting a new life in America.
And as you think about that, there's this line in the film from Bud Norris, pitcher Bud Norris, saying his comments he made last year to USA Today Sports about, hey, look, this is our game. If they're going to come here and make American dollars, they need to learn how to respect the game. And do you think there's still a feeling in baseball that like these are foreigners who are coming to play our sport?
Yeah, I think there's a segment of those who are in baseball and follow baseball who have that perception because they are fully unaware of the very long history of baseball in the Caribbean. And as I mentioned in film and elsewhere, Caribbean Latinos were the first group of immigrants who came with baseball. It was part of what they already knew what to do. This is not the story of the Southeast Europeans who were coming in the early 20th century, of the Italians who were coming in the early 20th century. They learned baseball here. And so what happens, people have this perception because baseball was seen as an agent of socialization and Americanization that Latinos need to do that too, but they come with baseball already. And so it's very different that way.
And how do you think that gets expressed today? I'm curious for both of you. I mean, do you think it is this notion of what Bud Norris says, maybe more explicitly, and other people say maybe not as explicitly, that, hey, Latinos are hot-headed and they're the ones who are clearing the bench and starting all of these fights, even though that may not necessarily be the case, obviously?
I think one of the things that we see is we really have a clash of baseball cultures in the major leagues. Because the Cubans, the Dominicans, the Puerto Ricans, the Venezuelans have this long tradition of how they play baseball in their society. And they're resistant to the U.S. model because they don't see it as fun. They enjoy and celebrate the game very differently and achievement very differently. That doesn't mean they don't take it seriously, but that's where the filter of American view comes in. It's like, oh, they're not taking this seriously enough. It's like, no, they're just enjoying the game.
Well, it's almost exactly the conversation we had last time you were sitting here, Adrian, about Jackie Robinson, right? Because this is what Jackie Robinson, this is when he started stealing bases. Everyone said, what is he doing? Why is he bringing this crazy play from the Negro Leagues into white American baseball? I mean, do you kind of see a similar story here?
I think that's entirely about how baseball, Major League Baseball, deals with difference. As an institution, baseball is very conservative in its adoption of or adaptation to difference. And I think one of the great stories about that was Vic Power, who was a Puerto Rican, black Puerto Rican who played with the Yankees. And he was the first baseman. And by the way, Caitlin used to play first base back
Thank
in the day.
who
went from the two-hand catching style at first base to the one hand. They called him a showboat. The Yankees actually produced a fielding report that he was a terrible fielder. But what he was an innovator. same thing with Omar Vizquel. He was called a hot dog because Vizquel was the first shortstop who would try to catch the ball on the outside of his glove when transferring it for a double play. And people was like, he's a hot dog, he's a showboat. Now they train first basemen and shortstops in throughout the minor leagues how to perfect that skill. And yet the players, the innovators themselves, suffered for the perception of their cultural practice and not for the efficiency and innovation they were producing.
So much of this documentary also has the history of the White Sox, and we can't do that without having a conversation about Minnie Minoso. And why do you describe him as our Jackie Robinson, Adrian?
Minnie Minoso was aware of what he was doing when he put on a Major League uniform, that he was the first Black Latino. And especially when he did it in Chicago with the White Sox, that he was pioneering integration in America's so-called second city at that time. And he understood that he was not just a ball player, and he was willing to take the punishment that came with that. And I think Rolando Cepeda said it best that, you know, we had two strikes against us, because one because we're Latino and the other one because we're Black. And yet we don't see many striking back. He led the league consistently in being hit by pitches. He understood that was part of the game, but he also understood he had a responsibility not to go out charging the mound with a bat in hand and clobber the pitcher because of the stereotypes of the Black man as a beast, uncontrollable athlete who, you know, his passions just override him. And that also, that redoubled with the hot-headed Latino image. And so many was known as a gentleman, and he was just a wonderful example of what an integration pioneer had to go through. And the other Latino players were very much aware, and that goes all the way through the contemporary moment where you have, when we talked to Jose Abreu up at US Cellular Field, and we asked him about Minnie, and he just, like, you know, there's this reverence of what he represents to Cubans and to Latino baseball.
And the thing is that was so interesting to me, and I guess I just never thought about it before, is how few people get to the Jose Abreu, Minnie Minoso. Obviously, no one's getting to that level, right? And there's so many 16- and 17-year-old Latino, they're kids, really, that are here in the U.S., and they're playing in the farm leagues, and then you describe October as a sort of brutal month where they find out whether or not they make it. And I was just really curious, what happens to those 16- or 17-year-olds if they're here and they're, I guess, brought in on different visas for different teams? Do they just get sent back?
Well, they need the visa to be working in the United States, through air quotes there, working. You know, that's their labor, and they come in on the specialized visa. And if they don't get called up to the next level, they lose their visa because the teams are the sponsoring institutions for those visas. And one of the really powerful things then is after 2, 3, 4 seasons in the minor leagues, if they don't advance to a certain level, teams cut them. And in some instances, they decide to become undocumented workers here in the United States. They don't go back because the jobs, they've prepared their entire life to be a baseball player. And as I share with my students, imagine what it means to be and particularly since they're 19, 20, 21 years old when they're in my class, imagine to be 21 and considered you're washed up. Your career ambition is done. What do you do next? And so we understand, or I understand, why they would remain here to support their family and to continue sending remittances. But the reality is that very few do become the Sammy Sosas, the Jose Abreus, and there's a far greater number who never realize that major league dream.
I did want to add that the pitcher that we do feature in the show has moved up to Double A. So he's moving up in the ranks, which is a very good sign.
I feel like I have to ask both of you how you're feeling about the Sox this year. We were talking about the Cubs being in first place. I feel like we've talked about that a lot on the 21st. So let me ask you though, Adrian, how are you feeling about first place?
You know, I think the White Sox are having a season that many people had hoped last year. You know, things have come together, and they were active in the offseason. So having Frazier, even though he missed a couple days recently, in the lineup to support Abreu, and the Sales dominating again. This is what many people had hoped last year. It took a little while longer, and it's funny how Robin Ventura doesn't look like such a bad manager.
Yeah,
now.
So how are you feeling cautiously optimistic? How are you describing how you're feeling as a Sox fan right now?
Well, I am a geographic.
Somewhat a geographic
I'm
Sox
a geographic
fan. Let's put it
Sox
that way.
Fan.
Sorry. Yes, and, to be diplomatic.
I'm a Yankee fan. But the other part of it
now
is,
you're going to get booed.
But what I do support is that Scott Reifert and other members of the White Sox management have been very supportive of my research throughout the time I've been here at the University of Illinois, bringing me up to speak for Double Duty Classics and doing events for many, that they have earned my rooting fandom. And I feel excited. I want this to be a hot baseball summer for Chicago.
Yeah, well, I think we've got it. Well, we've got it so far. Playing America's Game premieres Saturday at 6 p.m. on the Big Ten Network or immediately following the Illinois-Michigan baseball game. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you for having us on.
That does it for us today on the 21st. You can always find out information about past shows and how to contact us, links to our social media accounts on our website. That's 21stshow.org. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.